Right. I believe that we are in the 37th lesson in our church history study. And I have given this a title. I may have to go back into our online presence and make sure that this is titled correctly. But we're going to just call this particular segment Three Preeminent Churchmen. And we're going to study these three churchmen who actually lived during the 4th and 5th centuries, kind of a crossing over the 4th and 5th centuries. And we have begun our study with John Chrysostom. That's the individual we began with last week. John Chrysostom was born probably around 347-ish. There are different historians who date his birth differently. But we do know that he died in September of 407. That's been recorded for us with accuracy. He's actually from Antioch. We would normally call him John of Antioch, but he was given the nickname Chrysostom, I believe it was 100 or 200 years after his life. They didn't call him John Chrysostom while he was alive, as far as I know, at least not according to the historians. Chrysostom means golden mouth because of his oratory, because of his skill, because of his abilities in speaking. He was called the golden mouthed. So they gave him that name, John Chrysostom. He was born, his father died soon after his birth, and his mom raised him single. Her name is Anthusa, very dedicated, devout Christian woman. She was about 20, and she never remarried. She chose to raise her son in the nurture and admonition of the Lord as best she could, and so she did so, and she was very highly acclaimed by others for having done so. He was given an excellent classical education, and he studied rhetoric under the gifted and famous pagan teacher Libanius. We talked about him last week. However, as he grew older, John became more deeply committed to Christianity, no doubt the influence of his mom and others. And at the age of 18, he went to study theology under Diodorus of Tarsus. We talked about him last week as well. He decided to be a bit of a hermit, an ascetic, and he lived a very extreme ascetic lifestyle. There are chapters that are given over in history to what he did during that time. But he did live in extreme asceticism, became a hermit between the years 372 and 375. Sadly, his extreme asceticism caused him to have stomach problems, kidney damage, and so poor health while he was away as a hermit. Poor health caused him to have to go back to Antioch. And so he went back to Antioch there as a lector. A lector is just someone who reads the text of the Bible in the services. He then became a deacon, and eventually he was a presbyter at the church there in Antioch. He was greatly beloved for his verse-by-verse expositions and for his practical applications to the lives of his hearers. So all of that is just a brief survey of what we looked at last week regarding John. I did share with you also that he spoke very forcefully against the abuses of the wealthy. It was not that he had any convictions about wealth itself. Wealth was a blessing in his mind. But the moral obligation of those who had a great deal of resources, they had this obligation to care for the poor, to care for those in their communities. But they refused to do so. They spent all of their living on lavishness and heaping upon themselves feasts and garments and activities and anything you can just imagine. He had a homily. He wrote a lot of homilies. I shared with you last week that we still have many, many, many of his sermons translated for us and in print that we can read today. And I would challenge you to find some of those. They're online, easy to find. We have a library filled with Chrysostom's, his homilies, his expositions. And they're well worth reading. You would think you were reading someone from our day today, just reading verse by verse. This is what the text says. This is what it means. And here's the application of that. Very simple, straightforward, and people loved him for that. It was nothing elaborate. I wanted to read just one excerpt of his from the Gospel of Matthew, one of his homilies from Matthew. And this is what he writes, quote, Do you wish to honor the body of Christ? Do not ignore him when he is naked. Do not pay him homage in the temple while you are clad in silk, only then to neglect him outside, where he is cold and ill clad. He who said, "This is my body," is the same who said, "You saw me hungry and you gave me food." And whatever you did to the least of my brothers, you did also to me. What good is it if the Lord's table, he calls it the Eucharistic table, we would recognize it as the Lord's table. What good is it if the Eucharistic table is overloaded with golden chalices when your brother is dying of hunger? Start by satisfying his hunger, and then, with what is left, you may adorn the altar as well. Unquote. So, you know, in our worship services, of course, the Lord's table, the dishes on the Lord's table are very simple, very plain. But in the days when Chrysostom was preaching in Antioch, and then he will eventually end up in Constantinople, those tables were loaded with gold, the most precious of silver. And they were ornamented with just gaudy ornaments and very, very, very expensive. And the cloths that were used, the silks that were used to cover the tables. It just really, really irked him to no end. And you'll see what he did in Constantinople in a minute. So you can easily see how he would be a favored pastor among all the common people of Antioch. Not the rich aristocrats, not the imperial families, and not the clergy. And I'll read to you a little bit about that, about the clergy too, because they were up to their eyeballs in the same thing. But he was well loved by the people of his congregation because he fed them, literally and spiritually. He cared for them. There's one particular event that took place in Antioch, and it kind of exposes the power of his homilies and the persuasiveness of his applications. The emperor at that time, while he was in Antioch, was Theodosius I. Remember, he's the one who made the empire a kingdom empire, a Christian empire. Well, he had raised taxes on the people, and as you can imagine, there was an act of rebellion in Antioch by the people. The people took to the streets. There was a riotous mob. They began smashing all the statues, especially of the emperors, and of Theodosius and his family in particular. It was just, and I don't know if there were fires, I didn't read about that, but you can just imagine in your mind what it would look like when thousands of people take to the streets and start destroying things because they're angered over the taxes given to them by Theodosius. The bishop in Antioch, his name was Flavian, and he actually took a trip to, I suppose, Constantinople, where Theodosius was, you know, begging his forgiveness for these activities. This all took place during the Lenten season, right before Easter, those 40 days where they were celebrating Lent by this time. And Chrysostom took to the pulpit to preach against this. And he preached, it's a very famous series of homilies, there are 21 homilies called the statue homilies. And I believe, I didn't look, but I would almost imagine that we have that in our library as well, in the Nicene Fathers and their writings. I know you can look them up online, because I did. You can find them online. It's very easy. And he preached to his people during those days. During those 40 days of Lent, he preached those 21 famous homilies, those sermons to those people about their behavior and how they should respond, how they should respect civil authorities, taxes or not. And so those same sermons were influential in three ways. They softened the hearts of the citizens. Many of those people repented for what they had done. It caused a lot of people to turn in faith to Christ. They listened to those sermons and they turned in faith, and a lot of people were converted during those days, during those sermons. And then number three, it averted the punishment those consequences from Rome that certainly would have come to those people had Flavian and had Chrysostom not intervened. So again, that's just kind of an idea of the influence of John Chrysostom in the community, where his own flock were sinning against God, and he preached and they listened to him in his sermons. Finally, in 397, right before the turn of the century, and not by his own choosing, he was appointed by the Roman officials to be the Bishop of Constantinople. So now here's John Chrysostom, simple preacher, well-gifted orator, good speaker, good preacher, in Antioch, and now he is elevated to the position of a bishop, but not in Antioch, or not in a small assembly, but in Constantinople. This is the imperial capital, and now he is the bishop of that church. There are a couple of accounts as to exactly how Chrysostom left Antioch to get there. One of them is that he quietly, in the middle of the night, so that he would not disturb anybody or cause a tumult in the city because their favored presbyter was leaving them, he just secreted himself away in the night. There's another story that says that they actually kidnapped him. The Roman officials came to Antioch, grabbed him, tied him up, threw him in a cart, and carted him over to Constantinople from Antioch, again, in the middle of the night, of course, but certainly against his will. I don't know if that's true or not. I'm just sharing with you a couple of different histories as to how it happened. I don't know which one is accurate. But when he got to Antioch, when he got to Constantinople, the historian said that he just felt, well, he resigned himself to be there. God brought him there, and he'll do the best he can as the bishop in Constantinople now. As the new bishop in Constantinople, Chrysostom put an immediate end to the lavish banquets that many of the previous high-ranking religious and civil officials were used to. Here's Constantinople. This is the big church. This is the Hagia Sophia. And that's a church you can look up right now. It's a museum now, but it used to be this gold-ornated, that's a word, very ornate church, right? And he gets there, and they're expecting all these lavish banquets to be put on by him. He doesn't do it. That's no more. We're not doing that anymore. No more of this stuff. Many of the visiting ministers, they were used to, and they expected lavish banquets and gifts from this very rich church in Constantinople. But he wouldn't do it. No more. So you can imagine these very pompous religious individuals coming in, and where's my banquet? Where's my feast? Where's my, all of this? No more. He told these visiting ministers, most of whom had these individual lifestyles filled with all kinds of moral decadence, and he told them to go back to their churches where they are meant to be ministering to, and serve them. I can just imagine this fellow coming in, he's a reformer coming into this place and just tearing down all of these icons and talking to them like Paul spoke lovingly and kindly to those Ephesian elders. Feed the flock of God. Care for the flock of God. And he would tell them, go back, and rather than spending your time in all this opulence, spend your time in the study. Develop. Prepare your sermons and feed your flock. And he spent this time telling them. So he boldly told these visiting preachers, go back to your churches where you're meant to be ministering, and they didn't get any payout. He urged them to spend their time carefully in developing well-prepared sermons. And that, of course, made him some serious enemies. All of his religious peers began to be disgruntled. So he's a man that is pretty much alone, except for the love of his congregation, for his good preaching, careful exposition and applications. It is said that he sold a lot of the gold and silver bowls, all those plates, those serving dishes, those utensils, all those things, even all those golden vessels that were used in worship, he just sold them all and took that money, gave the proceeds to feed and to clothe all of those helpless people in his community. He financed hospitals. He cared for orphans with that money. And so you can imagine he's very well beloved by all the common people of his community, caring for these people who needed it. Again, we noted earlier that he spoke forcefully against the abuses of the wealthy, not having the wealth, but the oppression that they forced and the abuse that they gave to other people. It was in that work of his, of providing for orphans, providing for those at hospitals, feeding, clothing the poor, that he met and then developed a very strong bond of friendship with a Christian woman by the name of Olympias. Well, that's a name that's pretty much lost to history because of it's just sort of a side note in Chrysostom's life. But she was very influential. She was very helpful to Chrysostom. She was born into a rich family, and she had a great deal of wealth. She got married, and her husband died a couple of years after they were married. But she chose not to remarry and to use the finances that she had, the resources she had, to take care of the poor, to take care of those in her community. She did the best she could to feed them, to care for their wounds, to house orphans, to provide for all of their needs. And she was doing all this before Chrysostom even got to Constantinople. And it was due to her devotion to Christ that she remained single and dedicated her life to and her wealth, you know, to providing for all these needs. When Chrysostom came to Constantinople, he met her, and by that time she was in her early 30s, very active in the work of benevolence. While they spent a great deal of time together, they had a deep fellowship, friendship developed because of that work, because they both had the same interest, right? So a deep fellowship became, and it lasted the rest of their lives. And while they spent, and this is from the biographers, all the biographers that I've read, which is only like three or four, but the biographers I've read about Chrysostom and Olympias, they said that they spent a great deal of time together. He was overseeing much of the benevolence work that she was doing, and she would care for him. She would provide meals for him. She would take care of his clothes, mend his clothing, right, do his wash and laundry, right, things like that for him. So there was this mutual, you know, give and take and friendship that developed. But according to them, there was never the slightest hint of any impropriety between them. Nothing, not even the smell of smoke, as it were. So they had certain guidelines that they lived by. They were never, ever together alone, on principle, things like that. So we're glad, you know, for that. It is a big, because a lot of these people, that's not the story. That is not the story. And it gets worse and worse. Later in our lesson, we're going to learn that Chrysostom was eventually banished. Actually banished twice. Olympias is also banished because of her friendship with Chrysostom, their relationship. So he's banished, and so is she, and probably some others along with her. In her banishment, she sends correspondence to John, expressing her despondence. Right? So he's banished, so is she. But they're able to get these communiques back and forth. I don't know how many days, weeks, you know, that it took to get them, but that's the story. And so she's sending her letter. She's despondent. She has questions. You know, why is it that God is allowing the righteous to suffer like this? Something that we would ask the same questions. I don't know about you. Maybe I'm the only sinner, but why is it that bad things happen to, you know, good people? I want to read to you a brief portion of his letter to her. This is, and you're going to say, man, that's a lot. Well, this is just a piece of the whole thing that he wrote to her. So let me read just a portion of it, just to kind of give you a flavor, just a taste of his kind of a heart that he would write care for someone else. He says this, quote, "The present life is a wrestling school a gymnasium, a battle, a smelting furnace. Therefore, just as tanners grasp the hides and first work them vigorously, stretching, striking, and dashing them against walls and rocks, and by countless other treatments, render them fit for the reception of the dye. This is why they bring out the prized color. Just as goldsmiths throw the gold into the fire to purify it, delivering it over to the testing of the furnace. Just as coaches train the athletes in the wrestling schools with much hard work, attacking them more viciously than their opponents, so that every part of their bodies might be adequately prepared for exercise by this exercise for the grasps of their enemies and for an easy escape. So in the same way, God acts in the present life, desiring to create steadfast and patiently enduring people. Nothing, my dear Olympias, redounds so much to the credit of anyone as patient endurance in suffering. For this is indeed the queen of virtues and the perfection of crowns, and as it excels all other forms of righteousness. For in proportion as the strain of the affliction is increased, in other words, just as you might imagine those afflictions, and just as there you have more and more and more, just as you have a little affliction, a little more, a little more, a little more, just as those afflictions are increased, are the garlands of victory multiplied. We have the victory wreath, all right? Today, runners in a race get a medal, right? In those days, they got a garland on their head. So we want to run the race. He's telling her to run the race with patience, and you'll receive that crown, that garland of victory. In proportion as the gold is heated, does it become purified? The hotter the fire, the purer the metal. One last quote. For the circumstances and events of the present life have the character of a journey, but the realities of the future that await us is our true homeland. And so, in other words, we just keep fighting the good fight. God is working in us what He desires to work in us until our final delivery home. Just a flavor of his writing, and there's lots more. His forceful preaching against the wasteful and lavish lifestyles, finally, after so many months and years of preaching there in Constantinople, it drew the ire of the emperor's wife, and her name is Eudoxia. I've heard her name pronounced Eudoxia, but I've learned it Eudoxia, so I'm going to pronounce it that way, please. She was the wife to the emperor Arcadius. Arcadius was a very weak man, very, I don't know if he was a simpleton, but I know he was very, had no backbone at all. So I kind of liken it to Ahab and Jezebel. She was a very strong, bitter woman who controlled the reins in the home. The problem was that she presented herself as a Christian woman. And so she was a role model to all the other Christian women in Constantinople. So they would look to her and they would imitate her. And so Chrysostom has a little problem on his hands with this woman who is dealing with this. So he preached even further on these abuses by these women, specifically Eudoxia. In fact, I don't have it in my notes, but I remember reading that he preached a sermon on Ahab and Jezebel. And someone said that that was the last straw, that she'd had enough, that he likened her to Jezebel, right? And she's sitting there. And she's the emperor's wife. And we're talking about a man in a pulpit in Constantinople, and probably up in a gallery somewhere special, set apart from all the commoners, would be Eudoxia and Arcadius if he decided to show up. And he's preaching this about Ahab and Jezebel, and she takes offense, saying, she's called me Jezebel. Don't know if he really did. I don't know if he intended to do that. Maybe it was just he was going through the Bible and came to Ahab and Jezebel, and there you are. So she became very angry, and she conspired with other people against John. And you had what was what they call a perfect trifecta of opponents against John. First of all, you had the royal family. And this is the emperor and the emperor's, well, the emperor's wife and then the emperor. So Eudoxia, that's number one. You had the royal family against you. Number two, you had hundreds upon hundreds of corrupt and disgruntled clergy. So you had all these bishops from all over the empire, all these presbyters from all over the empire, all these archbishops, and they didn't like John anymore. They hated him too because of his preaching against their abuses and telling them that they weren't preaching and acting like ministers of God. And then thirdly, you had a man named Theophilus of Alexandria. Remember Alexandria? You forgot about Alexandria, didn't you? Alexandria was the prominent city in the empire. But all of a sudden, it was in the shade of Constantinople, the imperial capital. Theophilus was the bishop in Alexandria. And what do you think he really wanted? He wanted to be bishop in Constantinople. And there's another long story. I don't have time to get into it, but there's a story of a conflict between John and Theophilus regarding some men that were being supported, and this angered Theophilus. So Theophilus, obviously jealous of John for his having that position that he wanted, he traveled to Constantinople. The best way to travel from Constantinople from Alexandria is by ship. And you make your way across the Mediterranean over there. Not Theophilus. Theophilus took the land route so that he could visit as many churches as he could and get as many bishops and presbyters and clergy on his side when he got to Constantinople. He said then he could have the weight of all these ministers against John as well. So finally, there was a synod that was convened there in Chalcedon, which is right next to Constantinople. And Theophilus is the one who convened this synod. And they drew up 29 false charges at this synod. They're called the Synod of Oak. Trumped up charges, not real, just the most inane things you could think about to charge John with. He was falsely accused of selling off church property for personal gains. Remember I told you he got rid of some of those rich embellishments and used that money to provide for others? They said he spent it on himself. All right, John, Chrysostom. They said he misappropriated church funds. They said that he held the heresy of Origenism. We talked about Origenism. They said he was an Origenist. So they had, and there were 29 of these charges against him. So finally, in 403, Chrysostom was banished from the city of Constantinople. The story is that the citizens of Constantinople were so outraged over the banishment of their beloved Chrysostom that again, now not in Antioch, but now in Constantinople, they rioted in the streets and they threatened to burn down the imperial palace of Arcadius and Eudoxia. That's one thing. Another thing, another report is that there was an earthquake that happened the day that Chrysostom was banished. There's a third report that Eudoxia was with child, and the day he was banished, she gave birth to a stillborn child. So one of those things, we're not sure what, it could be because of the earthquake. A lot of people kind of lean on to that earthquake one, because Eudoxia was very superstitious, and she looked at this as a sign from God that they had done the wrong thing. So Chrysostom was immediately reinstated as the bishop. He reentered the pulpit completely intractable. I mean, he doesn't change a minute. All right, he doesn't change not an ounce of his preaching. He continued to thunder against those abuses, wastefulness of the rich. And in fact, there's a famous painting that I saw, you can see online as well, of a 19th century painter depicting Chrysostom standing in the pulpit with his arms spread out wide, looking up into the gallery where Eudoxia was standing, red-faced and angry. So there's a kind of a famous painting of that particular story. Another pivotal event that took place has to do with a statue that Eudoxia had set up for herself near the entrance of the church. So after he was banished and brought back, Eudoxia sets up a statue of herself in front of the church. All right, so nice. People gathered around it. There were tumults, there were parties, there were festivals. It was loud, it was noisy, and it interfered with the worship of the church going on inside. And so John preaches against all of this. He spoke vehemently against these people who had arranged these gatherings. Eudoxia and Arcadius are so outraged that they have John put in prison because he's preaching against these festivals that are going around that statue of Eudoxia. So they put him in prison. It was Easter time. And it was that time of year when large groups of new converts were baptized. So that was kind of a pattern they did. They would wait for to have a whole group of people to be baptized. They did it during Lent, right before Easter. The clergymen who were opposed to Chrysostom didn't want to see the church still functioning in his absence. And so they were able to convince the civil authorities to put a stop to the baptism. So Saturday night, all these people are gathered. They're going to be baptized before Easter Sunday. On that Saturday night, 400 soldiers entered the church and disbanded the meeting in a bloody fight. Can you just imagine soldiers coming in? 400 of them with swords drawn and just dispersing the crowd and cutting whomever they will. The next day was Easter Sunday and the church was empty. But all of the congregants, all of John's congregants, were gathered outside in the open for worship. So again, they're attacked by soldiers, and many of them were put in prison. Eventually, Chrysostom is now banished for the second time. And this time, he's banished to the Caucasus Mountains on the east side of the Black Sea. And that's where they send him. It's like the furthest edges of the empire. Chrysostom continues to pastor his church in Constantinople. He's writing letters back and forth, right? He's writing letters back and forth. And Eudoxia is just, she's fit to be tied. I can't stop this guy. How do I stop this guy? So she tells the soldiers that are with him, take him even further up into the mountains. He's not allowed to stop. He keeps walking. You don't provide for him. You just keep him marching in those mountains. And you know he's already compromised in health. And you know what's going to happen. He can't stop. They force him. They push him. Whatever food he gets, he has to beg for. Whatever water he gets, he has to beg for. Soldiers won't, under guard. They move him along. And so he's taken to the extreme edge of the empire. He's put up in harsh, frigid, and stormy mountains. And he's marched on foot from place to place, given no provision from the guards. And then sadly, in 407, Chrysostom's health compromised immune system, the severity of the climate, the conditions. He dies there in those mountains. Historians vary on exactly where he was in the mountains. Some say he was at a small little chapel of some kind, but there he is and he dies. But his last words were recorded. And his last words from John Chrysostom were these. He said, "Glory be to God for all things." And then he gave up the ghost. So that's my time is gone. That's John Chrysostom. And just a marvelous testimony to a man of God. Very simple, nothing ornate. A reformer, in a sense, coming in and just stripping away the church of all of this opulence. Taking the heat and the hatred of his peers, but yet standing firm on his principles. And still, in the face of all of it, saying, "Glory be to God for all things." All right, so that's John. Next week, we will turn our attention to Jerome. So if you want a little homework between now and next Wednesday, you can get in on your favorite search engine and look up Jerome, and we'll look a little bit at his life next week. All right? Let's pray, please. Heavenly Father, we thank you for the time together tonight and for the wonderful testimony of this man. We realize we don't look at men. We don't look to men for our example necessarily. Our example is Christ. And while we know that men have failings, John Chrysostom certainly would be one that would have a failing, have failings as a man. But yet we are grateful for the testimony that we read of his life and the dedication he had to your word, especially in the line by line, word by word exposition of the text, and then the careful application of that to his people. Lord, now we ask for your blessing as we enter into our time of prayer, and we are careful to pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.